The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to this special edition of the Sunday Space Show program. Great to be here. I know we're going to have a great time with our guest tonight, so let's rush through the announcements and get right into talking again to Rick Tumlinson. If you want to call us, the toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, we don't use any call screeners. Let it ring until it can be answered, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. If you'd rather use chat, remember, we use the AOL family, and it's IMICQ and CompuServe. The screen name is the same for all of those services. One word, Space Show Chat. It is up and working. If you don't see it, send an email to drspace@thespaceshow.com so we can reboot the chat program. But it is up and working. Should be visible for you. Email drspace@thespaceshow.com, thespaceshow@gmail.com, and dmlivings@yahoo.com. Remember, we're copyrighted and trademarked, and you do not have permission to do anything commercial with the shows or to change the text of the programs, but you certainly have permission to download, distribute, share, pass around these programs, and do what you can to get the word out as to why space is so important. You can quote from the shows. The only thing we ask you to do is use an academic citation to reference your quote. If you don't know how to do an academic citation, send me an email and I'll send you the form that you can use for any electronic media, not just for the Space Show. We certainly thank Gigadial and Andrew. They do our podcasting for us. You can find our subscription RSS URL in our website, both of our newsletters. Remember, we're iTunes compatible. Search for the Space Show or my name. We're in Podcast Alley. And you shouldn't have any problem with our podcast. If you do, please let me hear from you. Also remember, our comprehensive newsletter goes up Monday morning, and it is on the website. It has all of the week's details, bios, plans, and coming events. If we have to change or modify a program like we did this one, you'll see it first on the website newsletter, so check it from time to time. And then you can also subscribe to the very short email newsletter. Just send your request to drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything is archived, and you can easily listen to the shows from our website or download them. We have a store on our website, and above all, the Support the Space Show button, which you'll see on our website. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with One Giant Leap Foundation. We certainly need your support. Could not do this program without your support, and we thank you for supporting us. Remember to check OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. All of our guests who have written books have their books up as we're Amazon partners. If you do decide to buy those books, please buy it through the Amazon partnership with One Giant Leap, and then Amazon helps support the Space Show as well. Remember, we do Twitter and MySpace and Facebook and all of that kind of stuff, and just a couple of hold the dates that I'm telling people about. The Regolith challenges at NASA Ames coming up very quickly, October 17th and 18th, and then the Symposium for Personal and Commercial Spaceflight is in Las Cruces, New Mexico, October 21 and 22. That website, ispcs.com. If you're in the area or can get to the area, you certainly want to go. They have some tours of the New Mexico spaceport. It's well worth it. Remember also, the Space Show is brought to you in part by Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, visit secureworldfoundation.org. And then one more quick promo, and that is the special AIAA program that we're doing tomorrow morning, 11 a.m. California time, to 12:30 on the in-depth Augustine Commission. The panel that AIAA has brought to the Space Show features Doc Horowitz, Dr. John Kleinberg, Frank Culbertson, Elliot Polham, and Dr. Harrison Schmidt is returning again 11 a.m., 12:30 p.m. California time. You can hear it right here. And then that program will archive and show up on Tuesday. Well, listen, a great way to start World Space Week, a great way to talk about the fact that Spaceship One and the XPRIZE has its anniversary, 5 years, is having the guest Rick Tumlinson join us again. And Rick is back, and Rick is probably the premier entrepreneurial and visionary space businessman and leader that I know of. He has Extreme Space as a new company, Orbital Outfitters. He's a co-founder of the Space Frontier Foundation. His list is endless. He has been around. He knows all the players and some of the players who have not been with us for many, many years, like Gerard O'Neill and others. His full bio is already up on the website because Rick is a frequent guest on the space show, and it is really an honor to welcome you back to the show. How you doing, Rick?
I'm great. How are you?
I am. I'm very great, too, if that's proper English. I always do like to say that your family founded the Texas Rangers, and they fought at the Alamo. I love those parts about your background, so I always need to throw that in there. And when I was
helped co-found the Texas Rangers, they were at the Alamo. A short story. This is kind of an interesting part of that was that my ancestor at the Alamo. This shows. You know, you've heard of the Darwin Awards,
right?
We probably would qualify. My ancestor, after they were surrounded by Santa Ana. He and some other fellows from the town of Gonzales slipped out through enemy lines to get their crops in and came back and slipped through enemy lines back into the Alamo just in time for the massacre. On the other hand, I feel that the whole thing prepared me very well for what happened with us and our partners in Russia regarding the Mir project, because we're pretty good at martyring ourselves, I guess one might say. Back to space.
Well, all I can say is when I was in San Antonio on this February for the Sustain Conference, we went to the Alamo, and there was your relative's name carved on the wall. And then you go to the center of the Alamo, and there's the big plaque in honor of what everyone fought for and what it really means. And maybe it was a Darwin Award, or maybe your ancestor is a genuine American hero. So I choose the latter. And
I would say Texas hero. The reason I'll be careful about that, and we'll jump over into space real quick, is that I am not. I go up against people who say that somehow the settlement of Texas was an American conspiracy. These people, and this brings us back into the space area. These people that were in Texas at the time were people who had moved westward as the edge of the United States had pushed westward. They were definitely frontier people, and they were people who didn't bend, to the will of government and wanted to carve their own future. And there's some overlap with the kind of people we have in the space frontier movement.
Absolutely. The only thing bad about Texas is that UT has a too good of a football team when compared to Oklahoma, but that's another story. But you're right. I mean, they were very self-sufficient. They fought for what they believed in. I mean, they're still that way. If you listen to what Rick Perry says when he goes to Congress and stuff like that, he still has that attitude.
I want to be also very careful to let people know that we are not all Republicans.
No, I understand that. But, I mean, to go into space and to deal with the harshness of the frontier, you need a little bit of that attitude.
I think I absolutely agree. And I think probably somewhere, if you dig deep down inside of my head, get past the scary stuff, but you will find that my attitude regarding the frontier, regarding space, was melded when, as a child, I spent a lot of time in West Texas with my grandfather. We used to call Papa T. He was definitely a cowboy type of fella. And I would spend time doing the kinds of things you would expect to do, learning how to hunt and fish and things like that. And at the same time, spend my evenings reading science fiction. So maybe those two kind of blurred in together and helped form my attitude. But I, you know, look, I want to be very clear about this. I believe the frontier persona, the frontier psyche is something that anybody can have. I don't care what country you're from.
And it's not Republican or Democrat for sure. It absolutely transcends all that crap.
But it's an attitude. You know, we should have a bumper sticker, you know, space. It's an attitude. Not a latitude. Anyway, go ahead.
I like that. I may get one made up. That is cool. Okay, so we're 5 years after Spaceship One. What have you to say about it?
I'm excited. I'm very much excited about where we are in history right now. For a lot of us, this period right now is it's a marker. It's not a culmination by any means, but it's a marker along the way in a very, very long and hard-fought revolution. And what I'm seeing at last, you know, keep in mind that it was in the mid-80s where a bunch of us were gathered under the tutelage of the godfather of space soul, Dr. O'Neill, in Princeton, and having conversations about dedicating our lives to this cause. And in that crowd of people were, you know, Peter Diamandis and I think Bob Richards was around at that point from ISU, and then Peter from the XPRIZE, and Jim Muncie, who worked on the Hill and got some of the major legislation passed in that same crowd. Eric Drexler, who wanted to look at how to make things smaller because the cost of getting in space was so high and went off and created a little thing called nanotech, was also a protege of O'Neill. I know I go through this litany pretty well every time I talk to you, David, but I think it's important that people understand that there's a common thread, a common root to what we called, and we literally, at that gathering or at those gatherings, coined the term the benevolent conspiracy, and we a lot of us dedicated our lives. David Gump, who was one of the co-founders of LunaCorp, Jim Dunstan, there are a whole list of people who are still fighting the fight today, and then a wider circle that were evangelized or heard the message of the high frontier, which was Jerry O'Neill's message, that have gone on to do a lot of great stuff. Coming back to the XPRIZE itself, I was honored, you know, by Peter to be asked to be one of the founding trustees of the XPRIZE. And Peter, interestingly, got the idea essentially from a book that was given to him by Greg Mariniak, who was the number two under Dr. O'Neill in Princeton back in the day. And the book was on the spirit of St. Louis, and it talked about the Ortega Prize that they were all competing for at that point, and I think a light went off in Peter's head, and he went out and started fighting tooth and nail to put together a viable prize. At the same time, and this is a very important point to me, that since people need to understand revolutions are fought by a wide range of people over a wide range of disciplines, and what they share are common ideologies, but they each employ their own skill sets, their own capabilities, their own networks, their own abilities to do things. And so at the same time, you had other groups that were working on different technologies. You had people like Bert Rutan, who was already out there working on composites and has said, I think, several times that he would have probably gone out and done something like this at some point. You also had people... one of the groups I was lucky enough to be associated with that had gone out and taken over the Mir space station, which showed that there were people who would be willing to invest. As we joked at the time, we found ourselves a billionaire. Now it seems that people are finding those billionaires quite frequently. Then with the signing up, again, something I was lucky enough to be associated with, the signing up of Dennis Tito, to fly into space, we were able to show that there were people willing to pay a premium to be able to fly into space. You put those together with the, shall we say, ground truth demonstration that Peter was able to coalesce in the form of the XPRIZE in the showing of a capability that would fly a vehicle, if not necessarily to orbit, but at least high enough where you see the, quote-unquote, the famous words now, black sky, and can have that experience. And maybe you're not paying the $15 to $20 million that Dennis Tito paid to do a week or so at the space station, but you are on the edge of space. You are weightless. You are getting the spiritual and physical experience. And so he was able to do that. And so you put those pieces together, and voila, the next thing you know, we have begun a shift where we are going from an abstract discussion about what the frontier means to us, what is possible in the frontier, how it could someday happen, to actually seeing the first pieces of it, the reality of it coming together.
So at Spaceship One and XPRIZE really opened the door and turned the corner as far as I'm concerned. It changed so much.
Yes, it was definitely a very high visibility proof of concept that this could be done. And kudos to Peter, the XPRIZE team, to Bert Rutan, to our friends up in Seattle who invested in Bert Rutan, to the Ansaris who took the leap of putting the money up that was used to fund the premium, shall we say, for the hole-in-one insurance policy that was put together to fund the prize. And frankly, I got to give kudos to the person who did the due diligence for the insurance company that put up the money that bet against anybody succeeding, for not noticing that Bert Rutan was building a vehicle that could actually win. There was a real interesting twist that occurred there, and you know, had those people who were putting up that insurance money, and I don't know if your listeners are aware of that, but the concept was that a policy was put up that was funded by the Ansaris as far as paying a premium that basically said that we don't believe anybody will win this prize. And to do that, the Ansaris basically had to put up enough money to place, shall we say, that bet, say, well, we believe somebody will win. And what happened was that insurance company basically went out and looked around and couldn't see anybody that they believed would actually win the prize at the time. And although it was interesting because many of us in the field kind of, we knew about Bert and we knew what was out there and we knew what the possibilities were, but somehow, I won't get into the details of that, that's for other historians, shall we say, to write that full story, but they missed the fact that Bert Rutan was out there with at least the capability for the first stage to pull this together. So it was a very interesting quirk of history, but you need those kind of things to happen at times, to make things happen. And by God, it worked. And, you know, I was there standing in the field watching when Spaceship One flew and, you know, with my heart in my throat and like everybody kind of cheering, go, 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 go. And it was an amazing thing. It was also amazing watching the actual XPRIZE flight that occurred, you know, a month or so later after the initial flight. That Bert did, and it's just, you know, and then Branson pops up with the money, and off we go. So yeah, it's a very exciting time, and I'm really pleased to see it happening. The industry got the attention that it had been seeking for a long time, and if you don't mind, I do want to also mention something else that I thought was maybe not as glorious in its visuals or impact, but something that was very much fundamental to allowing the revolution to occur was later this same year, around the same time period, a group of people led by a bunch of people in the Space Frontier Foundation, people like Jim Muncy, a group of people working out of the X Corps hangar in their own time, and others had worked their tails off to get some legislation passed in Washington. And that legislation was very much of an enabler, that was a moving in the general area of liability and such, that sort of legislation and the definition, the definitions of these sorts of vehicles was absolutely critical. If you didn't have all of those elements, if you didn't have the demonstration that we were able to provide with the mirror, if you didn't have the signing of Tito showing that the money was there, if you didn't have Verrucan's amazing, amazing technical capabilities, if you didn't have Peter's stick-to-itiveness and just downright stubbornness and ability to stay the trail until he ran it to ground, if you didn't have the Ansaris, if you didn't have Jim Muncy and the people from X-Corps working the hill, if you didn't have Dana Rohrabacher in Washington at the time, all of those pieces, if you didn't have them, we might not be having this conversation today. So to wrap up that little speech, I just want to say that for me it's very important that people understand that they need to look, you know, three paragraphs down from the headline or four pages in from the front page of the book and understand that these sorts of flips, where the zero becomes a one, shall we say, don't occur just randomly. They don't occur based on one item, one effort, one person. They are the accumulation of a set of social, political, economic, psychological activities that result in literally what they call the tipping point. And I think that was a serious tipping point.
Do you know the name of the insurance company? I'm curious. Probably some others are, too, with that.
You know, I wish I had had time. As you know, I've been traveling. I thought about that, and I have heard of them. I cannot recall. It's out there. It can be found. But there was somebody else would have to follow up with you on that one. I recall, and keep in mind, I'm giving you sort of rough anecdotal tales here from the inside, but it's roughly as I said. Don't quote me exactly on all of it, but roughly as I said, that's how it occurred. The juice is in there. If somebody ever wants to dig into these stories, you know, heaven forbid, there'll be a lot of juice coming out of these tales of the space frontier over the years. But you know what? It worked. The bottom line is it worked. Billions of people for the first time were exposed to this concept that you too could go into space, and that the price wasn't so astronomical. You know, when you get it down to 200 grand, and I believe that price is going to fall dramatically in the first few years of this this new space race occurring, you're talking about the kind of money that a person, a retiree, could have saved for some great thing. You're talking about something that somebody could put together with a mortgage or a second mortgage. You're talking about money that real people, not your high-end celebrities, not your billionaires, can actually pull together. And what that does is it opens up the experience of space to a much larger possible group of people. That's the next phase, David. That's what's going to happen next, is spurred by what we saw in the late 90s and early part of this century leading up to the X Prize. We are going to now see the rolling out of these different vehicles, the flying of these different vehicles, and in parallel, we're going to see, it's interesting, and we can analyze this in a moment if you want, but you know, we have some people that are jumping right over that and going straight to orbit in almost the same time frame now. Things are accelerating. So we're going to be seeing more and more and more people experiencing space. And that's going to be an almost viral marketing phenomenon.
Let me give you...
Go ahead.
I have a question from Connie in New York that I was going to ask you, and it ties in with what you're saying right now. Connie says, Rick, are you satisfied with the pace between the winning of X Prize and where we are now in the industry, or do you think it should have been faster, or do you think it could have been faster?
The day I'm satisfied is the day I'm out of the movement. So we'll get that as the, you know, just roll me over and put me in a home somewhere. So I'm never going to be satisfied with the pitch. It's a very good question, but the could it have been quicker? Of course, anything can be quicker, but I think it's about right. I mean, you had to go from the understanding, the cultural comprehension of what occurred in the XPRIZE period, and to the actual investment, to the actual development from that of companies. Now, again, I do want to be clear. Several of these companies were working on these sorts of vehicles and projects before the XPRIZE was ever won. And there were companies out there like X-Core Aerospace is one of my favorites. And as a disclaimer, I will say they are a customer of Orbital Outfitters, but that came after the fact. They were one of my favorites. They were out there working on vehicles. Armadillo Aerospace has been working on vehicles for a while. Several of the other firms have been doing things like this. So, yeah, it could have been quicker. But, you know, for me, the sad part is that it took so long to get to the point of the things we did with Mir and to the point of the things that happened with the XPRIZE and to the point of flying a Tito. That's the period of time that I lament the most, that we went from walking on the moon in the late 60s and then had this tremendous gap wherein during this period where the government wouldn't get out of the way, and by staying in the way, created almost a psychological barrier in people's minds to where they couldn't believe that they too could play. And but we're over it now, hopefully. So we'll see what happens. And you know, it's as I like to say, I maybe I've read too much J.R.R. Tolkien, but the you know, the dwarves and their elves are out there right now crafting their magic, and we're about to see it happen.
You have a couple of comments from Rita in Los Angeles, who you know. And Rita says, first of all, regarding the insurance company taking that bet, no doubt the person who did the due diligence and authorized putting the money up for it probably got fired, right? And then she went on to say, if I can find it on Instant Messenger, the price of the Titanic dive, which I did, went up from the $30,000 I paid in July 2005 to $54,000 next year when they finally started the dives up again. Dives don't, trips don't always go down in price.
That's an absolute truth. In fact, the orbital flights have gone up in price since the Tito flight. Keep in mind that the real real price that Tito paid was not the $20 million that was put out in public. It was down closer to 15 or so, and that was sort of the what was a you know came out of after we signed him up for Mir Corp to fly to the Mir and. It's the, you know, and then he got transferred over to ISS. Now, one of the reasons on the orbital flights that it's gone up is that price variable isn't necessarily based on any sort of market competition, which would drive the cost down. It's based more on what's going on between the governments and the needs for progress, transport vehicles to space station, and Soyuz capsules, resupply and recrewing. So to speak, crew transitions at ISS. So it's not really based on any market competition. I would dare say that a similar thing has happened in the trips down to the Titanic that Rita mentions in her email. What we are going to see, though, is going to be slightly different in this field. You know, we're not looking at a single point destination that is dominated by a single or very few, one or two carriers here. What we're going to see is the breakout of several companies offering a variety of different sorts of flights. Keep in mind that, you know, Richard Branson, and here's where I get to eat it a little bit, as you might say. You know, I always said that you couldn't call the people that did these kind of flights. I actually wrote an editorial in Space News on this, that you shouldn't call Dennis Tito a space tourist. That when somebody straps themselves on the top of a rocket and puts at risk the kind of things that people like that were doing, I wouldn't necessarily call them a tourist, A, and B, I thought it was terrible marketing. You don't sell the grandest frontier of all time by labeling those who go there tourists. And C, it also gave the government an out so that they could look down their noses at these nasty tourists who could be classified. You know, in my mind, a tourist was always somebody in a you know, a flowered Hawaiian shirt with three cameras around their neck, a trail of Orangina bottles out behind them pissing on a sacred monument wasn't the best image. However, I did always say that at some point we might get to a place where when you and several of your quote-unquote best friends are sitting in something and the nice lady at the front says, look left, look right, you know, and the picture's snapped, then you would definitely be at a tourist stage. Well, in apology or in agreement with my friend John Spencer in the Space Tourism Society, I will now say that what Branson is doing is indeed space tourism. What he is going to be doing is taking you and, you know, several of your new best friends, putting you in a vehicle, and you're going to go up and have a shared semi-passive experience and, you know, the ride of a lifetime. So you can definitely call that tourism. I know I've kind of gone off on a slight tangent here, but I do want to make that distinction that not all of the different companies, I think Bezos is probably going to be giving a tourist experience as well, where you can have several people sitting semi-passively. Some of the other companies are being a little more, there's variation in what they're doing. You're going to have, I think, from what I understand with the X-Core experience, it's more of a right there in the cockpit experience. I know the Armadillo thing is still up in the air, but it's going to be a smaller, more intimate sort of a tourist experience, more of a almost a joyride experience. But one thing I do want to make clear, we can come back to this at the end, is that we are going to see competition. We're going to see a wide variety of experiences. Oh, and I should say, another reason I don't like to call them tourists is I am dealing with the extreme sports side of the world. And the last thing you want to tell somebody who wants to, shall we say, space dive, you know, out of a vehicle is call them a tourist. I mean, you know, they'll rip your head off and walk away laughing. So we are going to see a wide variety of experiences. We're going to see competition. We're going to see costs come down. And we're going to see a variety of costs based on the type of experience. From low suborbital, you know, in a horizontal takeoff, horizontal landing vehicle like the X-Core vehicle, to vertical with the Armadillo, one or two people, three people at a time, straight up, straight down in what I call the glass elevator ride, to the tour bus, which is the Branson experience, and from what I understand, very similar to the Bezos experience, all the way up to the full orbital hotel stays that you're going to see with the Bigelow Space Station. And you'll see researchers also going to variations on a Bigelow station or the Excalibur Almaz type of experience as well. So it's going to be a wide range, a lot of cost variation, a lot of competition, and a lot of very different experiential ways of entering space.
We have a caller on hold, but first, Jack in Virginia said XPRIZE Insurance was with Lloyd's of London. So thank you. And I have a whole bunch of questions from Jack, but let's take our caller first. Caller, are you still with us, please? Caller, are you with us? Hello? Caller? Okay, I guess the caller got off the phone. So
I wore him out.
Yeah, I guess so. Caller, if you got tired of waiting, call us back, please. Here's Jack's question, since I mentioned Jack. The first one was, there's a recent article published indicating that you are now working as a space consultant for Accomack County, Virginia, to boost commercial space launch investment at none other than the Mid-Atlantic Regional Spaceport at Wallops Island, Virginia. From your knowledge of commercial space launch, why should space launch firms like Armadillo, SpaceX, Bigelow, Aerospace, X-Core, or others fly from Virginia's space launch range instead of someplace else? Talk about a loaded question, Jack. What have you to say, Rick?
Well, obviously the disclaimer has to lead the answer in that I am indeed working with the good folks at Accomack County. There's some really great people there in Virginia, and it was actually Jack who introduced me to them. I want to turn this around for just a second on Jack, speaking of some of the heroes of this cause. Jack Kennedy is an amazing fellow who almost single-handedly, and I'm not taking away from anybody that's worked with him because they'll agree, has helped put the state of Virginia on the map as far as becoming a real space state by setting up some legislation there that has it having some of the best personal liability protections, et cetera, regarding personal space flight. He was the one who helped craft with a team there the zero G zero tax legislation that in the end got Orbital Sciences Corporation there in Virginia. And so we need to really honor people like Jack, and I would encourage others in other states who have an interest in seeing their state get involved to go for it. And I'm not undercutting my quote unquote client here by saying that. I think that what we have are a lot of opportunity. I think that this market is going to be big enough that there can be many states that play. There can be many nations that play. Interestingly, I've got an article, I think, coming out next week in the Isle of Man Examiner newspaper that talks about how the Isle of Man has gotten involved in underwriting and financing some of these efforts. But specifically relating to Virginia, there isn't in the northern, heading up the coast, shall we say, from Florida, which is an obvious behemoth in this area, where I am right now, actually. There isn't really another area moving up the Atlantic coast that is more suited for commercial spaceflight development than Virginia and its partner Maryland in the Mid-Atlantic Regional Spaceport. Those folks know that, too. I mean, think about it. You can fly off of Wallops Island on a one of these vehicles as a commercial spaceflight participant, and the view, the spectacular view of being able to see almost the entire eastern seaboard, a large part of the Atlantic, and then back into the United States and down towards Florida itself. That's an amazing view, number one. Number two, people who are going to be flying out of that area, that whole demographic, the whole eastern seaboard demographic of people, the wealthy, the kind of people that can afford these tickets that are in New York and up and down the East Coast, they don't have to lose the kind of travel time they're going to have to spend to go, let's say, all the way out to New Mexico or to California. They're going to be able to sort of pop down, do their flight in a day or two, their training, and get back to work. So there's a lot to argue for it. And the thing that's the most compelling is the two things that are most compelling are that it is a new entrant in the field, yet it has a long tradition of being involved in space. Wallops Island has a huge tradition. It goes back decades of being involved in spaceflight. And yet, at the same time, they've eagerly embraced the new space community and are really going through a learning process. That's one reason I'm working with them. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this on the air, but a no-assholes policy. I have a problem working with people who are blinded, who will not adapt to new ways, who are not willing to adopt and to evolve and to learn. And I'll tell you, the folks I've run into in Virginia are exactly the opposite of that. They are excited. They're trying to do what they can. I know they're having an election there, and from what I understand, both of the gubernatorial candidates have put out statements strongly endorsing the growth of the Mid-Atlantic spaceport. So I'm seeing a lot of good stuff there. And you know what? I would love to see it everywhere. Hell, as we started the show by saying, I'm from Texas. I would love to see Texas step up to the plate. But right now, the state that I'm seeing that's really diving in there and grabbing the ball and running with it is Virginia. They're going up against Florida, which, I'll, to be honest, I have to give them kudos too. The people at the spaceport here in Florida have done an amazing job. They are way ahead of the curve with the infrastructure they have, and I think that the companies that are out there that are looking at where to fly from have to decide whether they want to be a small or medium-sized fish, you know, in a big pond, or a much larger fish in a small pond that's starting something new, and take that kind of risk.
You got a caller. Let's see if we still have our caller with us. Are you with us, caller?
I certainly am.
And you are? Speak up.
Rich Godwin.
Can you speak a little louder? You're really soft.
Rich Godwin.
Okay.
How are you, David?
Pretty good. And you?
I'm good. I'm. How are you, Rick?
Can you hear him, Rick?
I'm doing well, Mr. Godwin. How are you?
I'm good. How's your lady?
My lady is doing very fine. Thank you for asking.
That's good. First thing, I just wanted to say that Rick is not just a Texan. He is an honorary Brit because of his mum. And that should be remembered as something. He's not just a Texan. He is an honorary Brit, and we're proud of that. The thing I wanted to talk about was recently looking at SpaceX, and I'm not sure how much everyone knows about what's happening with the new cuts issues with them, and also with the resupply, but also the fact that with Dragon, Dragon is going to obviously start to own the downmass market from ISS, which he's very carefully designed it for. But he's designed the Dragon to be a reusable spacecraft. However, NASA has told him that, oh, no, no, no. Every time you send a package on a Dragon to ISS, it has to be a new spacecraft. So now he's going to be bringing the spacecraft back. The first few times, he's probably just going to be bringing junk. But then he's going to prove that he can land that junk safely off the coast of L.A., and then he'll get the downmass, and then hopefully the crew. Did you want to comment on that, Rick, and what you think about that?
Well, and thanks, Rich, for the call. Yes, my mom is from England, and David, you know, depending on who I get off the phone with, my accent will shift between, hey, how y'all doing, to hello, and, you know. But anyway, what we're seeing right now, again, is, not again, but what we're seeing is a transitional moment when the wiring of the once dinosaur's brain of NASA is undergoing a fundamental change. And shall we say, not all the neurons in the intellectual pathway that are required to make intelligent decisions that will evolve that dinosaur into a more nimble mammal, which is able to cope with the changes in the environment around it, have occurred. What I'm saying in a long way is NASA's trying to get it. There are people in NASA that really do get it, but the agency itself hasn't gotten it yet. They don't understand what they're dealing with yet. So they don't know how to talk to new space. They don't know how to deal with the frontier movement yet. They don't understand at a very visceral level the core concepts that are required to successfully open a frontier in economically sustainable, accelerating manner. And one of those core concepts is reuse and recycling. Interestingly, by the way, side note, I think it's really interesting that given how the new generation, I don't know what letter of the alphabet we're in right now, X, Y, Z, or back to A, but what's happening in the psyche of the new generation that's coming up around the world is a real Earth awareness, a real understanding of the concepts of recycling and reuse and efficiency and global unity, etc. Interestingly, those are exactly the same concepts that apply to opening the frontier of space versus the old government program approach. You see, in a government program approach, you're given a budget that you need to waste as flagrantly as possible, and in a way that you know, gives the most attention or creates the largest splash, no pun intended, with the reentry, and feeds certain constituencies. So you're actually penalized for efficiency. If you come up with lean, mean ways of doing things, you're not going to get the kind of budgets that you want. You're not going to be able to keep the same number of people employed, et cetera, because after all, it's a program. And government programs of the sort we're talking about in space, for example, are not designed to prosper and grow and go for, you know, limitless expansion on their own as far as providing wealth and creating opportunity. They are designed to feed themselves within their own limited ecology that they occur in, within their own limited sphere. And so you've got to use it up so you can get more. That's exactly the opposite of what New Space is about. That's exactly the opposite of a frontier concept. So, yeah, it's really hard for NASA to understand. They're trying, and I think, you know, the more that they have to work with people like Elon, who is an amazing fellow, the more they have to work with orbital sciences, the more that, you know, what I'm also seeing, David, which I find fascinating, and Richard, is that there are people getting this in places I would have never thought, you know, 10 or 15 years are going to get, 10 or 15 years ago are going to get this concept. And I mean places like Boeing, you know, and Lockheed Martin, places like that, where you're seeing people beginning to say, I understand, you know, we could take this vehicle that we've been using for another purpose, and we can build a capsule that's reusable and put it on there, and by God, we can operate it in such a way, you know, that you could sell some seats on it. And that's what you're seeing partnerships between people like Bob Bigelow, who's building the inflatable orbital structures, and Boeing. So, yeah, they've got to learn it. They've got to get it. They haven't got it yet. The what we call COTS program and other programs like that that are aimed at giving a tiny pittance of money to the commercial operators, and I mean a pittance. These are scraps from the king's table, but they are scraps. And given the efficiency of new space companies and their ability to take a minimal amount of funding and apply creativity and reusability you know, market forces to those scraps of money, we're going to see some good stuff come of it. But, yeah, it's just the beginning. You know, I'm not going to get frustrated about it. We just have to keep hammering them until they get the point.
Richard, anything else?
There was one other thing that I'd mentioned to Rick recently that he always gets annoyed with because he thinks that I shouldn't be talking about it, and that is fusion reactors. And I've been telling people because of our company, we've got some very interesting characters coming out of the woodwork recently. And some of the, I like to call them the graybeards. And these are guys who worked in amazing government facilities for years and years and years, couldn't talk about what they were doing. One of them is a gentleman called Bob Bouchard, who worked on the NERVA program. And he kind of disappeared off the radar for quite a few years, and nobody knew where he was. Well, we learned recently that he'd been contracted out by the Navy for 18 years working on the Wiffle Ball. And the Wiffle Ball is a, I think it's called an electrodynamic fusion reactor that works on boron carbon 11. And they got the thing working, and they've now got an RFP out to build what's called a Wiffle Ball 8 and a Wiffle Ball 9. The Wiffle Ball 9 is a 1 gigawatt fusion reactor that they want to put on battleships to fire the new railguns because they don't have enough power on them. And this thing is actually being built. There's an RFP on the Navy website right now to build this thing. Surely we all should know about this. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. Is that it?
That's it.
Okay, thanks. And I'll clear out that line for someone else.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
Rick, let me get through some of these questions, okay?
Sure.
This one is from Marshall in Dallas, and we're going to go back to a couple of different topics. He says the Google Lunar X Prize is about putting a robot on the moon. Do you know if anyone has yet proposed a follow-on prize of producing the first gallon of lunar water? Is it a worthy prize?
Interesting. Yeah, we should come over to the water subject on the moon here in a few minutes. One quick aside, I do want to address Richard's point regarding fusion energy. There are certain technologies and that are amazing if they succeed. And I'm not going to roll my eyes and go, oh, my God, and, you know, fusion, or, you know, the usual line, fusion is always just 10 years away, and it's been 10 years away for 40 years. When we were running the Foundation for the International Non-Government Development of Space, where I was blessed to be in a position of giving away funding to different sorts of research projects, we actually gave money to some helium-3 fusion projects that Jack Schmidt and Jerry Kolchinski at the University of Wisconsin, one of those two states, they were working on. So I'm not someone who poo-poos that idea. I'm glad to see the Navy is working on it, and if that comes up the left field, comes out of left field and turns out to be something viable, then that's incredible. The budget, the kind of budget, the kind of infrastructure, the kind of capabilities needed and technology breakthroughs needed to make that happen are a little bit beyond what I can envisage being able to put to bear in the near term. And so I'm kind of working on a different side of the equation, and that's the same with, for example, the space elevator. It's a larger, much more advanced sort of technology that I believe comes into play in different realms of what it is we're about. So I let other people kind of work those areas, and yet I'm for them and I support them, and I think it's great if it does turn out to be a real breakthrough. Now back to Marshall's question regarding what I call moon water. And congratulations, by the way, go out to our friends in India, Chandrayaan, and amazing stuff. The Japanese, and I'm going to mispronounce it, Kaguya. All these different sorts of exploration probes and vehicles that are being launched by other countries that are not what we have grown accustomed to seeing as the forefront players in space. Absolute kudos. I'm so excited to see countries like that. Just imagine the pride of people in India right now regarding what they've done. They've made a contribution to the human expansion into space by helping confirm widespread distribution of water on the moon. Yes, it's a very light distribution relative to the Earth, but it's there. And if it's there, it's something we can get at. Given that you could take a fleet of robots or self-replicating machines or as they call von Neumann machines or whatever, and set them loose over a large period of time in a large area of real estate and actually mine what you need, I think it's an interesting concept. Regarding follow-on flies to get water out of lunar soil and extract water, I'm not aware of one. I don't know if it's appropriate yet. We don't want to, you're in this situation where you've got the Lunar Prize going, which I'm also excited to see, by the way. But should there be one? Yes. Is it time yet? It depends. If somebody wants to go up and raise the ante over the Google XPRIZE people and say, screw that, I'm gonna throw $80 million at producing a gallon of water on the moon. Hey, I love it. I think it'd be great. There are so many interesting concerns that we have to deal with in this area that it's when you start talking about water on the moon, it's going to be really interesting. I mean, for me, the big kahuna obviously are the poles and what we may or may not find in them. And I think there are people working quietly away, maybe not in the United States, but in other parts of the world that are interested in that also. And I think we're going to see some maybe surprising things occur in the next five or six years regarding people getting out there and trying to do something with the elements that we can find on the poles. But should there be a prize? Yeah, absolutely. I think that would be a great idea. I do want to mention, since we are roughly, David, if you don't mind, in an XPRIZE or a prize-oriented kind of period of time here, that we need to understand that prizes are not the real drivers in the long run of the breakthroughs that are going to occur here. We have to have an ongoing demand, and we have to have an ability after a prize is funded to meet that demand. The kinds of things that we see with scaled composites as a follow-up to the XPRIZE and the other companies are based on the fact that there is a provable, quote-unquote provable, and I'll leave that kind of loosely stated, but a possibly provable market that comes after the prize. If we throw a prize out that says produce a gallon of water on the moon, unless coming right along after that is a potential market for either the moon, either that moon water or the elements hydrogen and oxygen that make it up, which, as you know, can be recombined to make rocket propellant, unless there's an ongoing market demand for that post-prize, you've pretty well got something that's spectacular, but it's a dead end. And a lot of people will not, the kind of people that are going to fund teams to go after a prize, unless they're doing it just, you know, just so they can say, hey, we did it, you're just going to have a hard time finding people that will invest in teams to go after that unless there's a market afterwards. I will promise you this, that I believe that any of the teams that are going to win or get close to winning or even are in the ballpark as far as winning the Google Lunar X Prize are going to be those that have fought well beyond the prize. They will not be funded. They will not get the support they need to go to the moon unless they can prove to potential sponsors and investors and other possible stakeholders in their mission planning that there is something that goes beyond the prize. So we have to look at that because I tell you what, if somebody came up and said, $50 million to produce a gallon of moon water, I would probably put together a team that would launch a probe and somehow finagle around this or just to show them and go out and create a gallon of space water by going out to a comet or, something like that and grab that water. And because you know what? That water is actually going to be easier to use in the long run because you don't have to lift it off the lunar surface. So, you know, it gets into a lot of different nuances, but I think the main thing that people have to understand when it comes to prizes is there's got to be an ongoing market afterwards. If we know we're going to have people operating on the moon or the ability or the need to use those materials that are produced or the capabilities that are the end result of a prize contest, then I say let's go for it.
Let me go back and pick this comment up, which came in when we were talking about insurance for XPRIZE. This is from Randall Clegg at XCOR, and he said, for your information, our insurance broker is Duncan McGillivray with Shaw Moses Mendehill, which is snma.com. I don't know who the actual underwriter is, and he says feel free to credit me. So if anybody's interested in space business, launch business, insurance issues, check this company out. That's who's working with XCOR, and I would assume that would be a very good testimonial and recommendation. And then moving right along the line, and I think after this one, we'll probably take a break and give you a break as well. This is from Charles, who is in Mojave, and he's going back to the comments about the Virginia spaceport. Would there be range fees for or launch fees at the Virginia launch site? Would not that kill the chances for small startups like my company, Micro Launcher? Startups can't deal with upfront cost and can and will circumvent them. And this is, again, from Charles in Mojave. Any comments on range fees?
I'm not going to get into the specifics of that because it's not a specialty of mine. What I can tell you is part of my job working with Virginia is not only to talk about Virginia to people outside of Virginia as far as coming there to fly their vehicles. Part of my job is to get the kind of dialogue going that comes from people like Charles and people like XCOR, people like Armadillo, and people like SpaceX and others, and to facilitate a dialogue so that the people operating the space facilities in in the Wallops area, Mid-Atlantic Spaceport area, are able to change the way they've been doing things in the past. Because in the past, a facility like Wallops, and there are other facilities around like it, so I'm just using it as an example in this case, somebody would roll in and say, I want to fly from here, and the way that they would be heard was coming from a traditional point of view is, who are these upstarts? We are. We have some fixed rate budgets here. We have a job to protect the public at any cost, and here's how we've always done it. And of course, the way they've always done it was based on, shall we say, the aerospace money and traditional space budgets. And of course, that would kill any new space company's chance. So I would urge companies like Charles and others to, you know, if they want to contact me or whatever, we can start a dialogue and get them talking, because I think the people there are working on structuring ways to make operating there cheaper. And, yes, there are certain fixed costs that are involved in those kind of ops, and you're going to run into those there. You're going to run into them in Florida. Which is, again, why I think, you know, there are, as I said earlier on, I think there's a variety of possible places for people to do different sorts of things. And, you know, Mojave is one of my favorite places for a lot of testing, especially your winged sort of vehicles, things like that. They've got some great people out there. The folks who run that spaceport are absolutely some of the leaders in the field. I mean, you know, just have blazed the trail for others. And I want to see them succeed as well. What we will be doing by bringing places like Virginia online, along with Florida, along with Mojave, along with New Mexico, along with, you know, I heard somebody talking about Alaska, and God forbid if my own darn state of Texas will ever get its act together and get in the game. You know, if we can get these people competing, then what happens is there's going to be a shift from who the hell are you showing up on my space facility, you know, you upstart, to, oh, you're a potential customer. What can I do for you to lure you here? What can I do to get you to operate from Virginia or wherever? And that's a major shift that we're seeing, and I'm happy to say that's what I'm seeing in the people in Virginia. So they're willing to talk, they're willing to learn, and, yeah, I think they're willing to work with small companies and in ways that might astound some listeners to the show.
Rick, let's take a break, and we'll be back in about 2 minutes. And we have a lot more to cover with Rick Tomlinson. Don't go anyplace.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. Our guest is an honorary Brit, certainly a partial founder from his family of the state of Texas and other good things in Texas. And the guy who's fighting and leading the way to open the space frontier for all of humanity, whether humanity knows it or not, Rick Tumlinson. Rick, I'm going to lead with the question we talked about on the air, okay? I mean off the air. So let me find it here. Can't believe I just lost it. Okay. This is from Jack again in Virginia. And so this is his question. While I have not met the folks at Interorbital Systems, what do you make of the Interorbital Systems announcing an orbital launch with humans from Spaceport Tonga in late 2011? What measures of credibility do you give the announcement from the Interorbital folks at Mojave? And Jack, Rhonda, and Rod are on the show once every year to 18 months, and you should go back and listen to their shows. They have a new deal where you can pay $8,000 and they'll launch a satellite for you. Rick, it's all yours.
I know you didn't want to ask me that one, David, but I urged you to ask me.
Well, I actually like them very much, so
yeah.
I'm mixed here because I know them well, and I like Rhonda and Rod a lot, and I wish them really well, but the ball is now in your court.
Yeah. Look, the opening a frontier takes all sorts of people and personalities, as I said before, and you got to play some people. Sometimes you have to play close to the edge. There's an argument that the XPRIZE itself, for example, wouldn't have happened if some people hadn't played close to the edge. But, you know, we have to be careful in our field. We have to be, look, we start as space cadets. Our credibility is questioned the moment we open our mouths and say, space, you can go. So we have to be 10 times as cautious, 10 times as credible. We have to have our arguments testable, provable. We have to be as safe as you can possibly be in what we do. We have to have systems that work, and we have to be able to back up our words with reality. I like those people, too. They're great people. I think that they're doing the best they can. They've struggled for a long time, and you never discount anyone unless they are, as far as I'm concerned, unless they're out there, constantly in their pitches breaking the laws of physics and time and space continuum that we live in. But we are at a very critical stage in our field. And I would urge anyone who is putting an effort together in this field to open space to be very, very credible in what they do. I am very concerned about the first time that somebody or some group of investors or individuals pops up in this field and claims that they've been ripped off for X amount of money, millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions or even hundreds of thousands of dollars because somebody made completely unsubstantive claims. I am more terrified, far more terrified, of the thought that what will happen the first time that somebody gets hurt or killed because the practices, safety practices, the testing and testing and testing and testing, the all the systems that you could possibly put in place to protect human life are not there, and somebody pops up and says, we're going to fly this vehicle, 5 times with a bale of hay and then stick a person on top of it, and then they kill somebody.
I didn't know they were doing it with a bale of hay.
I'm not talking about any specific
okay.
group at all, and I'm not saying that has anything to do with the people in question. I'm talking in generalities here, David, but we got to be careful, and we can't, we can't be careful enough in what we do when it comes to these areas. And so, yeah, I wish companies like theirs well. Some of the things that I've heard, and I need to do more research on it myself to be fair to everybody, but some of the things I've heard are a little outlandish here and there in some of these companies. I'm not saying theirs in particular, but I want to see everybody succeed. But we have to do it the right way. We have to do it safely. We have to do it credibly, because we're not out there. You know, when I'm out working with Orbital Outfitters and we're building spacesuits, you know, our spacesuit has to work basically 100% of the time. And we have to prove it and prove it and prove it and prove it and prove it before we ever put anybody at risk, and especially before we ever have an innocent customer out there donning our suit in an emergency. And the same thing goes, you know, at a larger level for people that are flying people in space. We just have to be very careful. So I would urge the people in Interorbital and anywhere else that are working on this, you've got to be careful with your investors' money. You've got to be careful with your customers' money. And please, I beg you, you've got to be careful when it comes to human lives.
Well said. I know we want to get into Augustine, but you got an advanced question from Virginia Jack, which I haven't asked you yet, and it really needs to be asked. It's a very good question. And Jack says, Rick, you have past experience in dealing with the Russians in the commercialization of the Mir space station. I might add that I just finished, Rick, a one-hour, four-part telephone interview with our friend Walt. And he talked a lot during segment two and segment three about the Mir experience and what the world would have looked like had Mir been able to be commercially successful. And he's read the Augustine Commission report, the executive summary, and he talks about Mir in light of what Augustine is reporting. Listeners, that's going to air as a taped interview. It could not be live because of the circumstances that Walt is in on next Sunday, Sunday the 11th. Of October. It's an interview that you don't want to miss, and Walt talks about his future plans when he eventually has his freedom back. I know he was involved in the Mir deal with you, but anyway, that just triggered it, and I wanted to put that out for the listeners. The rest of Jack's question is, do you believe that Americans should respond favorably if the Chinese were to invite the soon-grounded Americans to fly a mission to orbit with them, or would that be too big a blow to American pride? Should we seek to have China a member state of the ISS partnership?
Interesting question. Let me give you first of all, you mentioned Walt. I want to be really clear. There would have been no Mir project, and probably, well, I'm not sure whether Tito would have flown at all, if ever. Maybe so, maybe a few years later, whatever. But there would have certainly been no Mir project without a man of the vision and qualities that Walt Anderson had. When we were ginning up the idea, and I'd been working with Walt for several years, he had been a supporter of the foundation. We had been planning a lot of different things. When we were putting that together, he was there, and it was kind of a joke, and actually it was written in the Wall Street Journal that we got drunk on sake, and that was when the decision was made. And of course, you know, a person like Walt, a near billionaire that he was, and would not make a decision like that while drunk. We were talking about it at that point, and we had some delightful discussions over bottles of sake at the time, but the fact is that guy has incredible vision, and I look forward to him re-entering the field with us, and I hope that whatever wrongs have been committed against him can be corrected so that we can get him back more quickly, because I think he is a huge asset to the field, and I'm honored to say that he's one of my best friends, and I'm really excited about your interview. I'll be listening.
Well, yeah, and his, you know, he talks about his future plans, and space is very much part of him, and you know, let's hope that he is back among us sooner than later. I asked him if he was going to be part of the advocate community again and come back to space conferences. And I won't tell you everything because I want you to hear it. I'm going to be a good radio host here for a change. But I will say we did a whole thing on the importance, the value, and what Space Frontier Foundation has meant to Walt as well as to the space show and to me. You don't want to miss this one-hour interview next Sunday.
It sounds like a great commercial for, you know, obviously an organization that's near and dear to my heart.
Well, that's why I'm telling you it was really special. Okay, China and Jack,
China.
What do you think?
China. Look, that, you know, you know, sparking off the mere point that you raised there, you know, at that point, the idea of Russians just, you know, a little while after the wall coming down, right after the Serbian conflict, working with a bunch of neo-anarchist-oriented, you know, free enterprisers, libertarian at least, to operate a commercial space facility that was not, by the way, a tourist destination. That was just to pay the rent. Our goal was to mine asteroids and things like that, as I guess you'll hear next week. But the fact is, those were unlikely allies. And what we found when we sat across the table from our friends in Moscow was that these people had the dream just like we did. They spoke a different language. They had a different ideology. They came from a different background, but they shared a common dream. And that's what unites people who want to open the frontier. We get out into space, and we can practice any ideologies we want, wherever we want. If you don't like mice, what I'm doing in my space colony, go build your own, was the joke, you know, back in the O'Neillian days. However, you know, I am a guy who has a picture of the guy standing in front of the tank at Tiananmen on his wall, who gave money during that period to some of the students who were fighting, you know, for the cause of freedom under the communist regime there. So I do have ideological issues with the Chinese regime. I love the Chinese people. I think they're an incredible people, and it's an incredible nation. And I want to be clear about those two sides of my opinion. Given all of that, you know, everybody, how many of the components of the phones that we're talking on, the financing for the companies that invested in those components, how many of the aspects of the ability of our government to operate, et cetera, are financed by the Chinese right now? Now, if you're telling me that it's okay for the U.S. government to borrow money from China, if you're telling me that it's okay for us to go to Walmart and furnish our homes with Chinese goods...
Or wear their clothing.
Yeah, or wear their clothing, and then you're going to tell me that it's not okay to work with them to fly into space, I would have to say you're a hypocrite. The fact is that, you know, if we can help accelerate the opening of space by getting, you know, creating partnerships with people, you know, in China, then I say let's do it. I would not support things that actually play into, and it's a fine line, I know, but would play into the aggrandizement of the communist system itself. But wherever possible, if you could do a reverse infection activity where the free enterprise aspects of things and the ideals of the space frontier can be fed back into Chinese culture by their people watching the interaction between our people and them, and maybe getting a little infected with this idea of, wow, you know, we can work with these folks, and maybe there's something new we can do in space. There's some new place for us to try some new experiment in our society. Then I say let's do it. But yeah, look, it's about opening the frontier right now, and it's about doing it in as quickly and most efficient way that we possibly can, as long as we can avoid you know, destruction of the environment, abuses of human rights, illegalities, and again, you know, breaking the laws of physics, I think let's go for it.
Okay. Let's switch and talk about the Augustine Commission.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just throw it out there, generally speaking. A couple of options, constellations on the table, the flexible path is on the table. You know, there seems to be some tugs of war between different segments. Some members of Congress say, let's fund what we originally set out to do, and, you know, others may have a different perspective. And how do you see it?
You know, we are definitely a fork in the road ahead of us when it comes to what's going to happen with our government space program. From where I sit, people like Elon Musk, Bob Bigelow, the people at Excalibur, Almaz, X-Core, even Orbital Sciences, these other companies, are going to put together the infrastructure that's going to allow us the space frontier, to open the space frontier one way or the other. I used to talk in my lectures that frontiers are opened by the people, not government, that frontiers are opened by the people with the support of or in spite of their government. It's going to happen. The question we're really looking at is how quickly will it happen, how much the government will to do to support it happening, and how much will it happening the right way support the kinds of activities that we, the people, through our tax dollars, agree that we want to support vis-a-vis government, i.e., how much additional science can we get if we are opening space based on using commercially viable vehicles that are reusable, et cetera, et cetera. How much more inspiration will the youth of our nation get by seeing, you know, one or two government flights or yet another canceled massive government boondoggle project versus dozens or hundreds or thousands of opportunities to fly in space every year occurring in an ever more widening scope? Those are the questions that are facing us. Now, Augustine is coming along right at a very interesting point. The shuttle is being wound down. We still need to support our capabilities vis-a-vis the space station, their ability to get there and back. Ares is a complete failure disaster, as far as I'm concerned. It's an absolute disaster. What did you expect, you know? These are the people that bought us the X-30, the, you know, on and on and on. I won't even get into the litany of failed NASA new vehicle programs that never went beyond PowerPoint pioneering. The fact is, it should be canceled immediately, the Ares 1. It is, the next penny spent on Ares 1 is a waste of our money, and it should be stopped immediately. Do we need a large cargo capability into space? Is that exemplified in some of the other shuttle derivative type stuff? And do I understand the need to keep that infrastructure, workforce, political and business constituency in place by giving them something else to do in the near term? Yes, I do. Is the nation best served by taking the funds that we are pouring into the Ares dead end and other capabilities and putting them into commercial vehicles that are competing with each other and carrying payloads? Absolutely. The United States and the world must have what I call an orbital industrial infrastructure, or we will never get anywhere in the frontier. And orbital industrial infrastructure will only come about if we have commercially viable carriers transporting people, supplies, hardware, and equipment into orbit where it is being used, assembled, reassembled, and used to manufacture, mine, process, harvest, whatever you will, the resources of space in space, and thereby allow us to expand outwards. We have to have that, or we will get nowhere. The idea that NASA would want to continue on with a yet another state socialist, you know, rocket project is ridiculous. It shows no learning, and it shows no understanding of what's lying ahead of us. The Augustine Report strongly, I believe, and from the quotes from some of the participants in the report, strongly endorses the concept of seriously moving towards a private sector, public sector partnership in opening the frontier, in that the government will clearly and unambiguously endorse the concept that the American people themselves have the capability to build and operate the space transportation systems to LEO. In other words, NASA and the U.S. government needs to buy the ride, not the rocket. That is an absolute. As long as the government is specifying, as was brought up in one of the questions regarding SpaceX, where the government says, you know, we want you, hey, we're going to help you, Elon, we want you to, you know, and you can help us, and we can all work together here, and, you know, you give us a space capsule and carry our people up there. Oh, by the way, You know, we don't really care about the capability or your ability to deliver, but what we do care about is that you throw the truck away after every use. That's absurd, and that's how we've operated since Apollo. That has to change. Augustine gives us that opportunity. I know you've got a panel coming on tomorrow, and they need to be confronted with that question.
All right, so give me the question to ask them.
The question to ask them.
That's right. I'm waiting.
Yeah. Let me think about that one because I want to phrase it well. But the question, yeah, the question you need to ask this panel that's going to sit here and say, well, here's what we believe should come out of the Augustine Commission is, are they committed to opening the frontier of space? And are they committed, do they believe that coming out of the Augustine Commission and looking at some of the proposals that come out of the Augustine Commission, that they can really look the American people in the eye and say that the same old way of doing things will work in the future? Or are they going to take the recommendations that the Augustine Commission has offered them, several of the recommendations, and say, you know what? NASA's job of exploration doesn't begin at the Earth's surface anymore. It begins in LEO. And do we want to have our astronauts driving trucks and building buildings, or do we want to have them exploring? Do we want more science? Do we want more inspiration? Do we want more capability? Do we want more industrial might and new technology injected into the American economy? Or do we want to keep funding single-use government projects, most of which never make it off the launch pad? Now, I know that's a long way of putting it, but...
Well, I got the gist of it. Is it directed to any one member of the panel or all of them?
No, I would say pass it out to all of them. You know, Augustine gives us, here it is, Augustine gives us a chance to make real change in how we do space. Among some of the concepts put out by Augustine are those that would allow the private sector to start handling transportation to and from space and enable the growth of a private and commercial space economy that would feed American jobs, technology, inspiration, et cetera, et cetera. Are they willing to throw that away to keep the status quo going, or are they willing and would they support doing something bold and exciting and, yes, a little risky by endorsing the concept that Augustine has put out there that the private sector can take over the job of driving trucks and building buildings, as I said before? It's a very clear choice to me.
To and from LEO, right, is what you're talking about.
Yeah, to and from LEO. I'm not saying that right now, as we sit here, that the private sector has the capability to go to Mars. But you know what? If, and this is going to be what's really going to be funny, because the group, the entity, the culture that has the most to lose in the long run here as far as losing face and credibility is actually those people who are going to fight for the status quo at NASA, because they're going to look really stupid when we get to about 2020, let's say, whether or not they support people like Elon Musk. And somebody like Elon lands something, if not people, on Mars. And they're still puttering around working on the Ares 12 or the X-50 or whatever it is that's the next NASA failure. They're going to look really stupid. They're going to go down the toilet of history. They're going to be flushed down the toilet of history. So it's really interesting because that's what's going to happen. It's not a question of do they support the private sector, because if they don't, it's all going to fall apart. No. These guys are doing it. The frontier is being opened in spite of NASA. The question is, are they going to see what's happening all around them and grasp it and get ahead of it and use it so that the American people are getting much more of their money's worth, and by doing so, actually help the people of this nation do what they do best, which is innovate, excite, and lead?
Do you see the panel as being this is for the show tomorrow, as being representative of the NASA culture? Because you say, do you, speaking as if they have the power to make this happen, whereas really they don't have that kind of power, at least I don't think they have that kind of power, or are they just individuals and you want to know what their individual and collective think is on this topic?
No, we all know that, you know, those of us who are on these programs, you know, even the assembled group you've got tomorrow, aren't going to have the power to make these decisions. These decisions are made very quietly in back rooms and restaurants and places like that. You know, I was really saddened, frankly, by some of the comments made by the new administrator. I have a lot of hope for him. I think he sounds like a great fellow. I think he's a very smart fellow. But I think, I swear to God, David, I swear when people get into that building there in headquarters of NASA, there is something in the air filter.
You know, I was at a space access meeting, and it was right after Mike Griffin became the administrator. And you were talking about, you know, this is a friend of ours. He knows new space. You know, he's a believer in commercial space and on and on and on. And that world did not turn out that way, did it?
No, it didn't. I
remember your talk at Space Access.
Oh, I do. Yeah, I do. And, you know, I am an eternal optimist that, you know, somebody's going to come in there and get it. And I really thought from some of the things that Mr. Griffin was saying that he got it. And again, I don't know, you know, he didn't go out and cleanse himself or something, you know, every day of what he was breathing in that building. But it didn't turn out that way. And, you know, I was wrong. I really thought that by the words he was sending me privately, the things he was saying to me and to those of us in the movement, that he was going to make major change for the cause of opening the frontier. And instead, what he did was push right back towards an approach that was, you know, a command control, centrally commanded and controlled NASA-esque approach to doing things that was complete dead end. You know, if unfortunately, you know, and again, I was there when Bush made the announcement, and I was a real strong supporter of that, that we were going to go to the moon and on to Mars, etc. But the way that, you know, it began to be executed, I think, as I said several times since then, the distance between Bush's mouth and NASA's ears was greater than from here to Mars, and, you know, as many interesting things could happen in between, as one might encounter on that voyage. The fact is that what happened was we began to, all the different forces that have grown up and encrusted the NASA way of doing things and become this NASA we see today, began to go to work on the concept, and we ended up with a complete failure of a program, a complete anomaly, not an anomaly, it's actually the normal way of doing things in our government space program now, which is to make bold announcements, to put out, you know, great visions, and then to go to work disassembling those visions, breaking them down into pieces, and then systematically destroying the ability of anybody, and I mean this in a very sincere way, that anybody at NASA, the great people at NASA who are working on the individual parts, for example, going back to the moon and on to Mars, great innovative stuff going on. The contractors, a lot of great different things going on. The lunar scientists, science community, lunar exploration analysis group that I helped work with in the early days. A lot of great ideas being put out there as to what we should do, how we should do it, the technologies to do it. Like that incredible rover design that they came up with, where the suit was integrated into the rover. Things like this. Amazing stuff. And the people down at that level working in the space agency and university systems and everything feeding into it, really, really applying their heart and soul and imagination to the cause, being subverted and forced into an absolute losing situation by a system that nobody has the integrity at a high level to stand up and say isn't working and will not work. From now on, my test of a NASA administrator, and I'll say this starting with Mr. Bolden, is if he's willing to stand up and say, I cannot do what you have asked me to do with the tools you are giving me to do it. And it's not that I need more money. It's not about more money. Because if it was about adding a few billion dollars so that we could be successful in creating space vehicles or transportation systems or opening space, then Richard Branson wouldn't be flying, then Elon Musk wouldn't be flying, then Armadillo wouldn't be, able to fly things, and all these other companies wouldn't be able to do anything. They're doing things for tiny, tiny pittances of funding when compared to what's going into our national space budget. It's not about more money. It's about changing your end goal. If you're looking at opening a frontier and you acknowledge that that is your goal and you stair-step back down from that top-level goal and apply all of your activities towards that goal, and if they don't fit it, if they don't lead to it, if you discard them, i.e., stacking a bunch of Morton Fireball, whatever they call that company now that gave us the solid rocket boosters that helped destroy Challenger, hiring them to stack them on top of each other in an even more awkward configuration, throw our great astronauts on top of that, and act like that's a viable system for getting people to and from space in an economic manner. When you go down that path and you start thinking that way and you get away from how do we open the frontier, how do we create reusable systems that are economically competitive, that are creative, that can be built upon, that are frontier enabling, then you go off into the wilderness and you've wasted billions of dollars, probably killed some people, and certainly killed off the dreams of yet another generation.
Jack in Knoxville sent in this question for you and says,
is this the same Jack? Is he just moving from city to city, or is this another one?
No, this is another one. No, the other Jack is in Virginia, and he has another question for us, too. But this Jack is Knoxville. And he says, do you think the Augustine Commission report is the catalyst that is needed to change, or will it become just another report? Look at how many reports there have been on examining what needs to be done with NASA. The bottom line is the NASA administrator serves at the pleasure and follows the instructions of the President of the United States. So do you think the President of the United States wants the vision that you have been describing in terms of opening the frontier?
You know what? I love Mr. Obama. I really think he's a great man. I'm excited about his presidency. I'm excited about the way he's getting people involved. But as almost every president we've had for quite a long time, he doesn't get it in space either. He doesn't understand it yet. You know, what's going to happen in space is the kind of thing, the opening of the frontier is the kind of thing that everybody's going to say they get the day after it really happens. And what I mean by that is, you know, as we see the Bigelows and the Scalabalmas and the other companies and the Armadillos and all these guys come online and really start doing stuff, then they're going to slowly get it. Unfortunately, they don't get it. He doesn't understand it yet. And I'm sure, you know, that goes for a lot of the people there. Now, I will say this. We have some new people at the top levels of NASA that give me hope. And let me kind of wrap up this part of the discussion real quick on this, or in this way. For the first time, because I was there when we had the Reagan Commission, which was one of the greatest commissions that was put together. Dr. O'Neill was on that one. Louis Alvarez, who discovered the KT boundary where the dinosaurs got wiped out, he was on that one. They came up with one of the best plans, one of the best concepts ever. It was dead, DOA, just like your friend, your writer has mentioned. What we have right now is a fundamentally unique set of circumstances that has never existed before. We have in the form of these new space companies, the investors, the billionaires, the people and the technology that are out there in the new space field, in the frontier movement, the capability to actually deliver on the promise of commercial spaceflight, commercial space operations. We have in place in the NASA community, in the government sector, in the White House even, and in some of the staffing positions, people who literally come from the O'Neillian school of opening space as a frontier. There are people in the staff working in NASA and the White House who were members of the L5 Space Colony Society that I was in. I think you might have been in as well, David. They're there for the first time at top-level jobs. We have an economic climate that although it may look like a very bad time to some, to me is full of opportunities for creating new partnerships internationally and as far as different communities working together. So we have these different things lining up. We have a global consciousness forming in the world, which the next step beyond global is a universal, or shall we say solar system-wide or beyond the Earth consciousness. That's coming about right now, the concepts of space, solar power, et cetera, et cetera. We've got all of these things lining up right now, right in this place, at the same time that the last behemoth project, the space shuttle, et cetera, is winding down, which, by the way, I recommend, I believe we should fly the shuttle for a little bit longer. We should absolutely not put an end date on when we're going to get rid of ISS. The very core principle behind what we did with MirCorp, by the way, was recycling and reuse. If it flies, if it holds air, you know, if it's got electricity, et cetera, you use the sucker until you can't use it anymore, and then you sell it for salvage, or give it away as salvage so somebody else can creatively reuse it. And, you know, I believe that right now we're in a place where, you know, we can see these different things all come together, and in a way that will really mean a fundamental change in the relationship between the government and private space programs, activities. So that's what Augustine represents. You know, that commission has come out with some great stuff. This time, for the first time, NASA can't walk out the door and go, well, there's nobody who can fly these things. They're out there. Right now, they're flying. So let's see what happens. I'm pushing for some vision. I've been wrong before. You know, I keep hoping for the one-eyed man and the land of the blind.
The Cyclops.
They keep using that stick, all puns intended when we're talking about Aries, to poke that eye out.
Okay, you got one more question that I'm going to take because we're going over, and I know for you in Florida it's near midnight already. This is from the other Jack in Virginia that has been giving us questions all night long. Do you support the dash out of low Earth orbit option and building Ares 5 or Ares Light by the Civil Space Program? Is that the type of infrastructure that we taxpayers and space advocates need the federal government to fund?
No, it isn't. I believe, you know, look, there is an argument to be made that heavy lift capability, massive heavy lift capability, is something that we should keep in place, we should develop. You know, for example, one idea that I don't totally lose, you know, have what we call a Lewis Black moment over where my veins bulge out and I start screaming, you know, over is the idea of replacing the side-mounted, you know, space shuttle with a cargo carrier. Because, frankly, a lot of the private companies we're dealing with right now aren't quite at that capability level as far as carrying mass to orbit yet. However, the history we have in this country of those kinds of projects is they immediately go off the rails and morph into something that's completely unidentifiable and a complete dead end. So I'm a bit skeptical. Would I like to see that happen in the near term? Yeah, possibly that would work. Is the concept of any large-scale government program that doesn't depend on and literally have as one of its goals the seeding of the private sector, of a private sector industrial orbital infrastructure as its goal, does that have any chance or should it be supported? No. I would rather see 10 companies carrying one-tenth the size of payloads into orbit, having them assembled there by workers who would, by the way, be learning how to operate and build in orbit, and who would, by the way, be working for companies who had been teaching the financial sector how to invest in finance, underwrite, et cetera, those kinds of operations. I would rather see that happen than another massive government dead-end boondoggle when it comes to, you know, large vehicles. Is that a reality right now? I don't know. I don't know. I think the government transportation system, as NASA itself sees it, is a different creature than what I believe in and what we need. Do I have hope? Yes. Have my hopes been dashed before? Yes. We'll see what happens.
As we wind down the show, because it is getting late, how would you like to leave us? What would you like to say as concluding comments?
Well, two things, probably. One is that, I kind of started to touch on it, the reason that those in the, and I'm using this lightly for our friends around the world, but those in the quote-unquote old world of Europe were able to establish a foothold that turned into what we see, especially in the North American experiment, now in the South American as well, a viable economic, you know, behemoth in the form of what we see in the North and South American cultures today. The reason they were able to do that at all was that they had built up a coastal infrastructure up and down the coasts of Europe. They knew how to do trade missions up and with each other. They knew how to build ships. They knew how to operate ships. They knew how to hire crews. They knew how to navigate. They knew how to build ports. They knew how to transport goods and services. They knew how to finance them. They had people sitting in banks who knew how to underwrite missions of trade. They had legal mechanisms in place that allowed them to support and create systems of rules and navigation, etc. How the government could back different sort of bonding activities, things like this. All of that had been learned in their coastal waterways, which allowed them to then sail forth and open new worlds. The next great step that will allow us to open the solar system and beyond that we have to have is the development of an industrial orbital infrastructure. I did a thing in the 90s called Alpha Town, the concept of how we would be able to leverage off of the government's activities by creating a low-Earth infrastructure, the idea of all government transportation to and from orbit should have to be commercially provided. All expansion of our energy needs in space should be commercially provided, preferably off-site by power-beaming satellites that could then also sell their electricity to communication vendors, etc., and deep space missions, etc., in space. It would develop a utility in space that could be grown. All expansion of facilities would be commercially leased. Catalytic commercial contracts, C3 is what I call them, where you are hired to build a facility, let's say for a government use that is then, let's say, a 10-year lease, but you're also given a bonus if you build it two times as large and are able to lease it out to commercial users. You're also allowed to use the government logo, like the NASA meatball in your advertising, and you're given some sort of tax holiday, but it's completely understood that at the end of the day, you get to do with it what you want when the government has moved on to the next thing. These sorts of things. These are the kind of things we have to have now. If we don't have them, we are doomed. We are going to have yet another Groundhog's Day massacre as far as going through the same cycle of, promise, spend, fail. And we will not do anything that is exciting, at least with the combination of our tax dollars as it comes out of Washington in the form of NASA spending. My bet is on the private sector. My bet is on the new space companies. My bet is on the imaginations of the people out there that are bending metal, that are putting their sweat, that are putting their entire lives into opening this frontier in a way that is unfettered by the kinds of goals that government, as we see it right now, kind of warps our activities by. I believe that the frontier door, the door or gate to the frontier is being pushed open right now. We need some help. We need to lubricate the hinges. We need some help getting there. the vision of what we see beyond that gate, the vision of what is achievable, is in the hearts and minds and souls of the people in the new space community. They're the ones who are going to do it. Frontiers are opened by people with the support of or in spite of their governments. That's what's happening now.
What can people do, in your opinion, to be supportive of this process?
Flood. All the people on all the committees in Washington have anything to do with making sure that the free enterprise aspects of the Augustine Report are enacted with telephone calls, personal visits, et cetera. Educate them as to what's at stake. Contact people in the Obama administration if you have any pull there to educate them with what's possible and what's at stake. Write an editorial. Get on a radio show. Invest in a new space company. Come up with a new space idea. Sit down, talk to your kids about what they have at stake. Send them to school with the conception of hope and promise of the frontier. Just basically, you know, get off your derriere and do something about it. I mean, that's what it's all about. The thing that, you know, going all the way back to the X-Prize, going all the way back to the Mir stuff, going all the way back to all of these different things we've talked about for this last hour and whatever time period it is, David, that ties them all together is it's about people who said, I'm going to do something. I'm going to make a difference. I'm going to put my heart and soul into this vision. I'm going to find a niche. I'm going to go into that niche, and I'm going to do something that makes a difference. I'm not going to sit on my hands. I'm not going to accept the words of the bureaucrats. I'm not going to accept the lies of those who would lie to us about what they're doing in our name. I'm going to go do it myself. That's what it's all about. That's what frontiers are all about. And if you don't like it, go build your own space colony.
If people, when they hear this archived and on the podcast, want to get a hold of you, do you give out an email address or do they go through me?
They can go through you for now. I'm reachable, and they can find me out there. It's RickTumlinson@gmail.com is my, you know, my main address right now. Rick@RickTumlinson.com. I will say my website is being revamped. It was kind of taken offline for a while. It's coming back in, so it's a little dated, but it's going to be revamped. And, I invite people to do it. I've done it with Orbital Outfitters. We're doing it with Space Diver. We're going to come out with some other great things. My fiance and I and two other partners have just started a media company to work on documentary stuff, and the Space Diver television program we're working on. You just got to do it. And you know what? Even if you don't succeed, just get back up and try again. It's an amazing thing. The difference between passively letting somebody else do something versus trying to do it yourself, even when you fail, is transformational. I mean, without that, you wouldn't have, it's like the difference between somebody who wants to run an Olympic race and somebody who actually figures, you know, puts their lives into it and makes it happen and gets out there themselves. They may not win the race, but they're out there in it. They're in the race. I say get into the race right now.
Absolutely. And we learn by failing. Nobody wants to be the one who fails, but on the shoulders of those of us that have failed, we build successes. So everybody is really, really important, whether they're failures or successes. In a way, they're all successes. We need the failure to have successes. So everyone's got to get out there and push for it and work for it.
As long as you learn from the failures and don't repeat them, don't tell me you're going to do the same, you know, what's the definition of insanity, you know?
You're doing the same thing over and over again, yeah.
Right, hoping for a different result. That's what I'm afraid we're about to see in the government space program. I hope it's not like that. I see the sparks of wisdom there, and I see the chemistry aligning for that spark to ignite something that'll lead to a reaction that'll give us some ISP and push us out to where we need to go. I just hope somebody has the wisdom to aim the rocket nozzle in the right direction so it pushes it up instead of down.
A great way to end the show with a great visual. And I know it's late for you, so...
It's never a problem.
Dave. Never a problem, but we didn't even get to talk about your business ventures, so that means another show down the road for you, Rick.
Yeah, I've always been told I don't look out enough for my own pocketbook, but hey, I think in the end, the value that I get out of seeing this succeed far outweighs anything else, and it's an amazing time to be alive.
Absolutely. Enjoy Florida, and I'm sure you and I will stay in touch, and I look forward to the next time you return to the Space Show.
Excellent. Thank you, David.
Thank you. Now,
thanks to your listeners. They're a great group of people.
And I will ask your question to the panel tomorrow, and I'll let you know what happens, or you'll hear it, because it'll be on the archive.
It's down to under 500 words.
I'll get it succinct and tight. Don't worry. I mean, I don't know what the answer will be. It'll probably be even more succinct and tight. But they can't blow
the question.
They can't blow the moderator off because I'm controlling the show. So we'll see what happens. Thanks a lot, Rick. Listeners, that's it. Two shows tomorrow. Read the newsletters. It gives you all the details. Thanks for listening. On behalf of Rick Tumlinson and the Space Show, everyone have a great night. Goodbye.